Why did you decide to stand?
Because I think Bradford needed a change. If you're asking me specifically about Bradford East rather than why I wanted to stand generally, it was very obvious to me, having travelled the north of England, that Bradford seemed to have been slightly passed by. If you make a comparison with Leeds, Manchester or Preston or York or the other places that I go to as part of my day job, so to speak, they seem to be, I wouldn't say booming, but they seem to be changing and modernised, moving forwards. And Bradford seemed to me to be a really great city and a great community that didn't seem to be caught up in that wave. And I thought that was a sort of fascinating challenge. And to come to Bradford, which I have done, and I really enjoyed being here these last couple of weeks, and to see why that is, and to see how the Conservative Party can change that for Bradford for the better.
Do you consider yourself to be local?
No, I'm not local. I wouldn't pretend for a moment to be local. I was born as far south as you can go pretty well. I was born in Brighton. I was educated in Sussex. My closest connection with Bradford was I was slightly taught cricket by Imran Khan, who was Chancellor of the University here for about 6 or 7 years. But I do work, although based in London, we got offices in Manchester and Leeds and in Nottingham. So I'm up in the north of England a lot and spend a lot of time with professionals and other people up here. I don't see it as a disadvantage, actually. I see it as an advantage because I've come in to Bradford, perhaps unlike the other candidates, as an outsider. I've got no baggage. When I come to meet people, I'm not part of a council that some people think have failed. I'm not previous Liberal Dem MP who some people think has failed, etc., etc. So I can form, I hope, a reasonably independent opinion, and I hope can bring outside influence to bear and to help Bradford be the great city that it has been and absolutely will be again.
What do you think is the most important issue facing the constituency?
How we negotiate leaving Europe. In fact, this is perhaps more specific to Bradford than almost anywhere else. Bradford's greatness was built in the last century on international trade. I was in Undercliffe Cemetery, just looking around on my own, and I walked up to those extraordinary signs of wealth of the previous inhabitants of Bradford looking out over the city, and it made its money on international trade, on energy and international trade. It became, as you know, the second richest city, I think, per person in Great Britain. And we've got a situation now where we're going to come out of Europe, although not leave Europe, so we're going to carry on trading with Europe. But what we're doing is we're opening our arms to the rest of the world. We're going to be global. And I think that puts Bradford, which has a pretty diverse community with lots of contacts around the world, in a strong position. And if we have good investment in Bradford and we're Bradford, I think that Bradford will be a great city again, and I'm really looking forward to that.
What do you consider to be the most important policy?
Well, the most important policy is going to be further investment in schools, because whilst Brexit is immediate, we have to follow it up with highly trained, highly educated youngsters coming through the system. And we've been pretty successful since 2010, since the coalition government started and then Conservatives came in 2015. We had this last year 6.6 million children who are educated in either good or outstanding schools. It's gone up from 4 million in 2010. We have promised a further investment of about 4 billion in schools across the country. And we are getting there on that, despite what everyone says. And we want that to be even more, to take us further away and into the world and achieve everything we can for Bradford and for Britain.
Why do you think you'd be the best person to represent the constituency?
Because I think Bradford hasn't been heard. That the sense I get, and it's only a sense, is that people haven't been listening to Bradford, and what Bradford needs is a powerful voice. My normal work day is about being the voice for people in entirely different circumstances, I accept that. But I would like to be Bradford's advocate. I would like to be able to be returned if Bradford East constituents lend me their vote. I'd like to go to Parliament and tell Parliament about how great Bradford is. And I think that's what I would bring to bear as an independent voice from the outside who's come here, who's come to the conclusion it's a great place, and who wants to tell the people in power it's a great place. And I hope it'll be Theresa May's government. And therefore, I hope to be more listened to than the predecessors who, what I've been told in Thackley this morning, what I was told in Idle yesterday, what I was told in Ecclesfield the day before, and as I walked around the country, they haven't been listened to, and they want to be listened to, and I want them to be heard.
Theresa May has said that no deal is better than a bad deal when it comes to Brexit.
Yeah.
To look at an example of that, travellers to the EU currently are covered by the European Health Insurance Card, EHIC, for emergency healthcare in Europe.
They are.
With no deal, that will instantly stop. Is that really the best thing for the UK?
I think it's very difficult to break a deal down to small constituent parts. Obviously, the European Health Card, which many of us, I think, forget to take unholy with us most of the time, at least I do, is an important part of how the European Union has developed. But the problem with the European Union is that the regulations they brought to bear on other things have been too burdensome to people. it can't be beyond the wit of a competent government, and I emphasise the word competent government, to come to an agreement in relation to the treatment of citizens of their country in other countries in Europe. We would expect, and the citizens of France, Italy, Spain, etc., etc., would expect our hospitals, as we do when there are emergencies, to treat fellow Europeans in those circumstances. And I'm quite sure the same will happen for our citizens when they travel on holiday. I'm married to someone who's half French, so I'm very familiar with the French health system. And when they used to go on holiday before 1972, they were treated. There was a sort of agreement that that's what would happen. And I can't believe it's beyond the wit of a highly competent government, as Theresa May's party will be. If I'm asked to do the negotiation to help as a lawyer, I will do so. But I'm absolutely confident that we will get a deal. And if we don't get a deal, I'm absolutely confident in areas like health, we will be able to come to an agreement with all the different countries that they will treat our citizens if we are in trouble when we go abroad.
Currently, the UK gives about £500 million a year to EU countries, the care for Brits who have retired abroad. The Nuffield Trust has estimated that if those expats were treated back in Britain, that would double the amount it would cost to £1 billion. To put that in perspective, NHS in England received £120 billion last year, so we're talking about £1 billion. How does that factor into your economic planning and manifesto spending commitments?
Well, I don't think that factors in at the moment. I mean, as you well know, this is going to take place from 19 onwards. I don't think we're going to have a rush of people coming back into the UK. I would be very surprised if members of my family and my wife's family abroad are suddenly going to come back to England full time. I think the Nuffield's calculation assumes that everyone is suddenly going to leave and come back to the UK. I think they're taking the most pessimistic view about what will happen. And I think the Nuffield Foundation, who are a great foundation, and they're assuming there's going to be great droves of people coming back to live in the UK. I really doubt that'll be the case.
You've pledged £8 billion in your manifesto, an £8 billion increase to the NHS England budget compared to the current level by 22-23. Now,
yeah,
that works
years,
out
yeah.
as £1.6 billion per year if it's equally spread yep. out. Now, if you take the Nuffield figures into consideration, then you're instantly going to lose £500 million off that. And then you take into account inflation. Is this really a good deal for the NHS? We're only looking really at approximately a 1% increase in spending, especially when you've said that the economy has to be strong and stable in the first place.
Well, no, I think those two things, Anne, I think are taken together. We have pledged that. We will stick by that. The NHS has seen a constant increase in spending over the last few years. The great challenge, of course, we face can be broken down in a number of different ways in relation to the NHS. And I'm a child of medicine. My mother was a nurse. My father was a doctor. There are many more drugs that can be prescribed. They're much more expensive. We have an ageing population who we want to provide the best possible care. Modernisation means, in the NHS, there are different ways of providing that. I don't think you're going to have this sort of, if you like to make the comparison with the other parties, this ice cream for everyone type of manifesto, where there's going to be a bottomless commitment to the NHS.
You seem to have said there that you are committed to that increase on the NHS, but when you look at what Theresa May has said, she has said that it is only possible if there is a really strong economy to pay for it. And then you look at what Jeremy Hunt has said, the only thing that could upset it is if Brexit goes wrong and we don't have the resources to put in it. So it is not as cast iron as you're making
well,
it
nothing,
out.
Well, nothing. Obviously, you factor in everything you can factor in. As that expression, isn't it? Known knowns and known unknowns. We remember from a few years back, it was a slightly unfortunate expression. We absolutely do believe that Brexit will lead to a strong economy, and therefore we will be able to make those commitments to the NHS and to all the other areas we've made commitments.
Everything is predicated on this strong and stable economy. So what actually does a strong and stable economy mean in reality?
You use the word strong and stable. It's become a sort of expression. What it means is to put businesses and people in a position where they can plan. So what we want to see is we want to see businesses, particularly small and medium-sized enterprises, expand. We want to provide a lower tax base for corporations. We want to see corporation tax come down. Businesses expand, as I said to you earlier, Anne. You're going to have more people employed in those businesses. And pausing there, the proof of the pudding's in the eating, isn't it? Because we know that, unlike the Labour Party, who historically every single, and I emphasise this, every single Labour government has seen unemployment higher when they have left office than when they arrived. At the moment, we have very high employment figures in this country, and we want to see that improve. The more people are employed, the more people who pay tax, the more tax that's paid, the better revenue you've got.
Now, Theresa May is the first ever Prime Minister to U-turn on a manifesto pledge. How can voters trust anything else in the manifesto to stay intact?
I have to say, I think a U-turn was an unfortunate expression in relation to this. I don't think she did U-turn at all. I think what Theresa May did was very courageous. She started what is a very difficult conversation We have seen a number of reports, in particular, more recently, the Dilnot report in relation to the provision of care services. I've had my own personal experience of this very recently. I had a much-loved aunt, a spinster aunt, who we looked after and had to go in a home for the last 18 months of her life. In her case, she'd saved. She had a little flat in Sutton, just in the south of London, and that paid for her to go to this nursing home. But I know that many people can't afford that across the country. What happens when you get into your late 80s and into your 90s, and now, of course, all these centenarians, is we see that the cost of looking after them is much, much higher. It's part of that much, much bigger picture of how we manage health, how we manage the drugs we prescribe, how we manage people's expectations, and how we look after families, look after their elderly, and I welcome it.